Welcome to another edition of Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Dr. Stacey Raymond. I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Stephanie Samuels, director of COPLINE, which is a hotline for police answered by retired officers. Stephanie will be sharing about stressors in law enforcement and the barriers to seeking help. We'll look at COPLINE's role in removing those barriers and how they handle calls from a bad day call to a full-blown mental health crisis. We invite you to like and subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's Respond to Resilience. On Facebook, we're Responder Wellness, Inc. We're on bbsradio.com and Apple Podcasts. And our website with all our past episodes is respondertv.com. We'll be back to speak with Stephanie Samuels right after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW EMTB. And we'd like to welcome Stephanie Samuels to Respond to Resilience. Great to see you, Stephanie.
Thank you. Really nice to be here. Thank you very much for asking me to come on the show.
Absolutely. We'll just talk about your background a little bit before we delve into the conversation. Stephanie is a psychotherapist who works exclusively with first responders, mostly law enforcement in New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, and Oklahoma. And she's lectured all over the country on PTSD and vicarious trauma, including undiagnosed PTSD and the fallout from departmental silence after officers are involved in critical incidents. She began her career as one of the founding teams of Teen Line Cares, a mental health helpline for teens. And she recognized that teens only trusted and confided in other teens. So with that concept in mind, she went on to create two law enforcement officer hotlines, where she's currently the founder and president of COPLINE, Inc., the first confidential national law enforcement officers hotline in the country, manned by retired officers. And we'd love to learn more about you in the next hour. So, Stacey, why don't you kick off the questions?
Sure. Hi, Stephanie. Let's start with if you could just tell us a little bit about, like, when and how did your interest in working with the law enforcement community begin?
So it's kind of interesting. So I had graduated high school in the 80s, early 80s, 1981, and grew up in actually bicoastally. So I left New York when I was 12. So I had done my kind of middle school, high school, and then was going into college at the time. So I was out at UCLA. So I was on a plane. I had visited my grandparents back east before school started, and it was at the time that that the gangs were huge. So I was reading People magazine, because People magazine is, you know, the most informative. So you get all your facts from, because, you know, until, of course, Facebook came out, and then you got all your facts from Facebook. So anyway, I was reading that, and I was becoming a gang expert while flying bicoastally. You're looking at me, People magazine expert, because I was reading the article on gangs. Mm-hmm. And this female was next to me, and she said, do you deal with gangs? And I thought to myself, I'm now an expert. Of course I do. I'm still reading the article. By the end, I'm going to be an expert. So anyway, she and I ended up talking quite a bit, and she was explaining to me that her boyfriend wanted to get out of a gang. And I knew I was going to go into psych. I knew kind of what my path was going to be. So I ended up kind of being educated a little bit on the plane and figured, well, you know what, I can help him get out of the gang. I had no idea about OGs. I had no idea about jumping in, jumping out. I just knew that I was young, dumb, and this was awesome. So I ended up starting doing ride-alongs with LAPD and Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, who now are just such incredible, staunch supporters of Copline. It's just kind of amazing. Yeah. But I was the nightmare for those that do ride-alongs. So I was the one that they drew straws to see, and a rumor had it that they wanted to see who got Florence Nightingale that day, because I really believed that, you know, that these were just misguided youths and that they just needed to be loved or what have you. That did change. So I spent a lot of time riding, and then I decided that I really wanted to be a cop. Mm-hmm. So I began the process, and we had a call one night. I rode typically with the same sergeant. And there's nothing between, you know, he and I. He's just, I think, ended up being stuck with me most of the time. But I educated myself. I learned what the word stirpes meant. I can thank the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department for that. So at 20, I was probably younger. I was probably about 19 at the time when I signed this document and I was signing away my stirpes. I'm like, what are my stirpes? They're like your children. I'm like, good news, man. No kids running with the stirpes. And so after college, I thought, you know what, I think I want to be a cop. I think this is really kind of cool. But during the process, I went on one difficult call. I've been on many difficult calls. I'm the person that I don't do well with blood. Like, I'm a nightmare. Like, you know, now I can like look back and go, okay, it's absolutely a nightmare. The ultimate horrible wannabe in a car that was going to save the world. So, you know, when there were stabbings and there's what have you, I didn't do great. And there was a point in time with LAPD that they assigned, you know, plain clothes to deal with the gangs and what have you, and ended up going to a call. It really could have gone pretty wonky and ended up, you know, running out with the sergeant at the time. And I'll never forget it. There were cinder block walls, which Los Angeles has a lot of. Mm-hmm. And he went to jump the wall. And he looked at me, and the eyes of the soul. And he, you know, and what he spoke was, they know it's over that wall. I don't. I'm paid to jump it. And what I saw in his soul was he was saying goodbye. He was saying, I love you, but not a physical I love you, just as a human being. And he said, if something goes wrong, you've got to get back to the vehicle. You've got to call for help. And I just remember thinking, oh, shit. Like, this became very, very real at that moment. And I remember I'm thinking to myself, can I jump the wall? Not physically, but can I, you know, emotionally jump the wall? And truthfully, did I want to? Ended up meeting somebody, got engaged, ended up going to New York City, worked in housing projects on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, Avenue D, more deaths on the D than any place else in the city, and really got educated on America's Most Wanted Youth. We're funded by the Juvenile Justice Department. And I spent a lot of time with convicts. I mean, they're kids. I mean, but they were and realized that the mentality between a cop and a convict is very similar. So somebody took a right-hand turn, somebody took a left-hand turn. Ended up moving out to Jersey, started doing ride-alongs with cops, thinking, you know, I really wanted to see what services now. I had a pretty good idea of what was going on. I wanted to see what services were being provided out in Jersey. And I remember just talking to the director of the police academy at the time, and he kind of looked at me like, and I thought, ooh, I could be speaking LAEs. That's a different language out there. So I said, you know, who's doing your critical incident debriefings, officers involved in shootings, untimely deaths? And anyway, it was no one. And so that really became what has been 30 plus years of work for me. Ended up writing legislation in New Jersey, ended up really being able to stay to a mission, and still do. And so that's kind of a long story of this.
And it sounds like in your ride-alongs, you were learning the culture and building trust with PDs?
I didn't realize it at the time. I mean, I was young, and then when I moved out to Jersey, that I would take the whole shift. So you know, these guys were doing eights, some of them were doing tens and twelves. And when they heard that I was staying the shift, well, first of all, the look of panic, and I was like, "It's okay, you can coop." And the guys were like, "So for the first like 2-3 hours, they all thought that I was either put in there by their chiefs or internal affairs. By 3 hours and 1 minute, by the third F-bomb and clearly inappropriate comments about everybody on the streets are like, nobody put you here." I'm like, not only did nobody put me here, nobody did their due diligence, because the last person you'd ever want to put in your car is me.
Yeah.
So, and that actually, crazy, it ended up, I had quite a few of the guys that I rode with ended up in my private practice. Hmm. Because there was a trust that was built.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what it takes sometimes. They have to see you, hear what you have to say, and then they might talk to you about, you know, something that's a couple layers under the onion. So,
I mean, and I'm sure, you know, Stacey, you probably get this too. I mean, they look at me, they know I'm a female,
mm-hmm.
and probably born a female. So we know those things. And that I had never worn a badge. Yeah. So there's this kind of like, what can she tell me, you know, not having, you know, not being able to relate in any way.
Right.
Kind of getting over that barrier. And I think a lot of times people are more comfortable, you know, unfortunately, emoting with females. I just think society has made it easier to be able
to
do that.
Sure. So, for me, it was, I would tell them right up front, my dad was a police officer. And so that helped a lot, because they knew I grew up with whatever he took home, you know, which was hard. And it's no surprise that I work with a lot of police officers now that have PTSD, alcohol issues, marital issues, all of that. So it's come full circle. Can you tell us a little bit more about then, how did you segue to develop a hotline for police?
So I was 14 in high school, and there was a kind of a peer support back then. That was, you know, some of it was talking, but a lot of it was Scholastics. But ended up going through kind of a program in high school to learn kind of some peer work. And one of the people that was in that group, her mom was a psychologist. And so through Cedars-Sinai out in California, their mental mm-hmm. health is Thalene. So they ended up getting some money to start a teen helpline that we ended up being called Teenline Care. So I was part of the first focus group.
Mm.
Was one of the first teens that answered the lines, but it was brilliant. I mean, what Dr. Leader's still alive. She's 92 years old. I mean, I still mm-hmm. knew her as my mentor.
Okay. So yeah.
She oversaw cop line. She oversaw, you know, all the hotlines, the two hotlines that I did. And so as I'm riding with these guys, and I realized that if they just had somebody that could relate to them.
Yeah.
It would be so beneficial, but the importance of that was going to be confidentiality above everything else.
Right, right.
And then in my practice, I started seeing a lot of retired officers. Some of them had retired untimely. And so it was difficult to be, you know, in your 30s, done with a career that you still loved, and not being able to connect. You know, we know how difficult retirement is.
Right.
And so there became that match. And the other piece was, and I just had somebody from the Illinois area call me today that he wants to volunteer for Copland, except he's still active, is that if an officer is involved in domestic violence or any illegal substances or what have you, as a sworn officer, they have a duty. They have to notify. Mm-hmm. So we use, you know, and that certainly isn't, you know, a large portion of our population or our law enforcement population at all. But nonetheless, to ensure confidentiality, we have to make sure that they can talk about anything and that there would be no breach. So it became a really nice marriage. It gave retired police officers, or my belief was, if what I was seeing in my practice, and there's no reason why what I was seeing was not what was going on nationally, mm-hmm. was that, you know, retired officers were really taking with them the part of the job that they loved. Mm-hmm. And we're missing it. They don't miss the bullshit of the politics of no. all of that, you know. And it's been really important, you know, particularly during COVID. You know, I get asked a lot about, you know, COVID and did our numbers go up? Did our calls go up? Well, we don't have the bullshit numbers because Copline takes no state or federal money. So therefore, we don't have to say, oh, yeah, well, we got COVID money. So, of course, they went up. We saw a slight uptick. But the truth is, cops were prepared to fight the invisible enemy. They took the job knowing that. What they weren't prepared for was to become the enemy. You want the spike in calls. You want the content to change. George Floyd. That was where we saw the shift.
Right.
In Copline. So that's kind of how it started and where and the importance of that piece today. You know, still when it comes to the confidentiality part, I made a decision when I had founded it, that we were going to be what they call a non-rescue line, so that we were not going to ping the phones if somebody was saying that they were going to kill themselves, even if it was an imminency. And so when we do the vetting to become a Copline listener is really mm-hmm. pretty difficult. But in the beginning stages, that's the first thing that I, or one of the first things that I address after I go over their questionnaire or what have you, is that we are a non-rescue line. I also give them the statistics of how many people have died on hotlines, on the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is the oldest hotline in the country. So since 1963 to 2019, I haven't gotten caught up on it. They've taken over 7,500,000 suicidal calls, wow. of which two people died on the lines. Hmm. You better believe I am not breaching, because here's what happens. We ping a phone. Who comes to your door? An officer.
Right.
So your perception is you've now saved one officer. The officer that showed up at your door now goes back to his department and mm-hmm. says, don't ever call that line again. They're full of shit. They're not confidential. So that was going to be important. I mean, and our guys are trained incredibly well. We have, you know, and I will certainly address that if you would want. We've had, you know, our fair share of suicidal calls. It's about, probably counts for anywhere between 1.5. We saw a slight uptick recently to about 2% of our calls. But we have been very successful in being able to have that person reach out for help while we stay on the line. So whether it's a third party call while Copline's still on there, and the caller makes the third party call, or they text a friend or what have you and get them to the house or whatever. But stay on the lines for an extended period of time while doing that.
Fairfield County Trauma Response Team is a nonprofit alliance of mental health professionals dedicated to helping first responders heal from trauma, tragedy, and stress. We help as they manage community crises and the everyday demands of ensuring public health and safety. Established in 2011, FCTRT was formed in response to a call for emotional help from the Stamford Fire Department after a traumatic fatal fire. Less than a year later, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting occurred, and members again served the first responder community. Most recently, COVID-19 created a need for our support. We provide free educational presentations, pro bono sessions to deal with community disasters, and an extensive referral service to trauma-informed psychotherapists. If you're a responder in Fairfield County and need help dealing with duty-related stress, please reach out to us so you can continue to do the job you love. Visit our website at fctrt.org or find us on Instagram at Fairfield County TRT.
love the way that you've married, you know, your prior experience riding with cops and the fact that retired cops and retired responders in general really miss the job when they leave and looking for that mission and purpose. And you found something really amazingly fitting for them to do, to be of service to their brothers and sisters. So it's a great concept.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah. Let's just talk about this real quick, because we'll get back to it later. But what's the number for Capline if somebody needs to reach out?
It is 1-800-COPLINE, which is 267-5463.
Aside from not pinging the phones, are the calls recorded, or is there any other parameters?
Absolutely not. So there are four circumstances that we will breach confidentiality. One is if you're going to kill someone else. Mm-hmm. One is another one is child abuse or elder abuse. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth one is if you have killed somebody not in the line of duty. So unfortunately, we can't bear witness to somebody that is going to confess a murder. But you know what? We've never had any officer that has not said, oh, well, crap, those four things should be breached. You know, those aren't heavy lifts. It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue, is why would I call a line that can potentially to get help that potentially is going to take away my gun badge and patch? Yeah.
Okay. So if 1-2% of the calls are legit, I don't want to live anymore. I'm going to end my life. So my first question is, how do you handle that then? And then my next question is, what's the majority of the calls? What are those like? So let's go back to the first question. How do you handle that? Somebody says, I don't want to live anymore. I found out my wife's cheating on me, or I'm not going to get promoted. I'm sick of this job and I hate my chief, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you handle that?
So typically, and again, you know, these guys are trained. So it's 45 hours of active listening skills. Our lead trainer has the dual expertise. He was with the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Hotline, before he came as director of that. And then he went over to LAPD, and he is now with their behavioral science services. So Dr. Jay Nagdeman is a lead dog in this. And so it goes something like this. Typically the person calls up, they're crying, they're normally sobbing, many times inaudible. And the first thing that our caller will say, you know, they're trained to answer the phones. If it's me and I don't answer the phones at all, I'm not sworn, never have been, I would get on the phone and say, cop line, this is Stephanie, what's going on? And you're just here. Because may I help you? A lot of times we can't help. So we don't say, can we help you?
What's going on?
What's going on? And so now comes the sobbing. And so typically a volunteer would say, take your time. I'm here. And let them just cry.
Right.
And then find out, Dave, you've called in and you say that you can't take it anymore. You're typically drunk. People that typically die by suicide have substances in their body, mostly alcohol.
Yeah.
And so you're sobbing and you say that your wife left you. She took your kids. Nothing left. You've been having an affair. Your wife just found out. And there's no reason to live. And I'll say, my God, Dave, that is so, so difficult. I can hear how devastating this is for you. I'm just wondering, Dave, where's your firearm? And you're going to say, it's on my lap. And I'm going to say, you really are at a place that you don't want to be here anymore. I'm wondering if just for this call, would you mind putting that firearm in another room? You're in your car? Okay. Would you put it on the seat next to you? And if you say no, I'm not fixating on that damn gun. Because the truth is, A, you can be bullshitting me to begin with, that you've put it someplace and you haven't.
Yeah.
Yeah, and B, there's nothing that stops you while you're on the phone walking into the other room I've just had you put in and blowing your brains out. I'm not spending any time. So then we go from there. And then we talk about the pain. We talk about your wife. We talk about your kids. And it is truly active listening, which means it's without judgment and it's without advice. Two things officers love to do.
Okay, so that's hard. That's something they have to learn upon retirement if they're going to be a part of Copline.
Yeah. That is the 45 hours.
I mean, okay.
45 yeah. hours.
Right.
We've now completed 14 trainings, and of the 14, we've only had, I believe, one class where everybody ended up answering those lines. And these guys all pay their own way to wherever we're training. And put themselves through with the cost of what we pay for the training. But otherwise, their expenses on staying there for a week is on them. So it's brutal when they're not able to do that. But our lines and other people's lives depend on that.
Where do you do the training?
All over the country, actually. So we just came back from Tucson. We do about 3 trainings a year. The trainings are the most expensive part of our budget. Again, we don't take state or federal money. So
how do you make money then? How do you fund Copline?
We've had, before COVID, it was a little bit easier with fundraisers. So last year, so we always do the midnight run for the call, which is really, so that's here in Jersey. But it's done nationally. And at New Year's Eve, at midnight, and when the ball drops, we actually do a 5K. And we have the name of an officer on the back of our shirts who had died. Mm. And I don't care how they died, it's just that they wore the badge with honor. So we have teams that have been put in for suicide, what have you. But it's really sponsors. So that's been great. And then we had a golf tournament in Texas. And before that, we used to have a golf tournament in California, hoping to be able to get back there. COVID and those restrictions, that just got killed. And donations. Donations are huge. Hopefully, corporate donations would be lovely. Still have not found, what's my fantasy is to find that one corporation that loves, police or what have you, that will fund Copline. But until then, if you ever met, like I get to be the face, which is unfair, but I'm really just the smallest cog in this wheel. There are people, there are volunteers are the heart of Copline. And they are so vigilant about not only the calls, but they also donate themselves. I mean, not only their time, but Copline became their favorite charity. It's just incredible watching what So that's it. So we keep, hoping and staying our course, and I'm sure something will break. But we're just not willing to compromise integrity and confidentiality. I mean, that's pretty simple.
Our mission at Responder Wellness, Inc. is to subsidize or provide free of charge safety equipment and wellness services to first responders, including police officers, firefighters, EMS personnel, and 911 operators throughout Connecticut. Resources include scholarships to train new EMTs, a responder and veteran-only AA group in Danbury, Connecticut, as well as police vests, a fire and EMS boot program, yoga classes, gym memberships, and t-shirts. The founder of Responder Wellness, Inc. co-leads a peer support group sponsored by Fairfield County Trauma Response Team. Responder Wellness, Inc. is a nonprofit 501c3. Find us on the web at responderwellness.org, on Facebook at Responder Wellness, Inc., or email us responderwellness@gmail.com. Responder Wellness, Inc., putting responders first.
Just looking back at the sort of the mechanics of a call, somebody's calling for help, perhaps suicidal. Is there clinical backup for the call takers, the listeners?
It's me.
Okay.
And there are others. So we've got a clinical list. So if I'm going to be tied up or what have you, or God forbid, maybe actually take a vacation. But again, this is far and few between. Then I will ask another clinician and then send out a message to everybody saying, you know, Ann Bezik is on call. She's out in California. She's just wonderful with us. But the other thing that is really difficult, so my patients, just like my family, kind of grew up with me doing what I do for a living. And my patients grew up, you know, or have been in my practice watching, you know, the hotline become what it is today. So I will bring my phone into session. Because I make myself, if somebody needs me that badly, and I sure. have had a struggle with anybody who sees me because they know what it's like to be that person absolutely needing to get a hold of me, so that I find that they're almost grateful that it's not them. They're like, ooh, my brother or sister needs something. But it's so rare that our volunteers actually, you know, need anything. We keep like a snippet, a summary. And I always say, you know, keep what it is that you would want on you. And it's for another caller. So if Dave calls back and it was a relationship issue, so say Dave and it might have a 914. So we just have an area code. We don't have a phone number. And we'll just know, oh, so Dave from you know, 914 had called. And he was struggling with a relationship issue. Okay, great. So that's what we have. So that way, it makes it easier so that you don't have to start all over again or what have you.
Okay, all right. So the other 98% of the calls, what are those like?
95% of them are bad days. Officers, okay. A lot of times on their way home, I just kind of want to debrief, diffuse, do all of that.
Yeah.
So they're just calling and figuring it out. I talk about really two of my very favorite calls. Mm-hmm. One of them was recent and another one was probably about a year or so ago. And the year or so ago was a rookie who was on his way home. And, you know, again, a lot of our guys are really kind of older, seasoned and figured out. Kind of life and marriage and whatever. And so he was on his way home. He was in a relationship and he'd only had a couple months on the job. And he called up and he said, I see that I'm changing and I am concerned about talking to my girlfriend about this stuff and kind of, you know, went through all of that, on the way home. And he said to the retiree, he said, do you have any advice? Mm-hmm. And he said, son, he said, we don't give advice, but I'll tell you what you just did was the answer to your own question. We are here every single day, 24 mm-hmm. hours a day, that if on your way home, you just need to get stuff off your chest, by all means call. And the other one that was recent was a woman, I'm assuming in her 20s or 30s, probably in her 20s, who is the daughter of a police officer who had passed away, and she wanted fatherly advice. Oh. And so she called up and kind of, you know, shared, you know, that her father had passed and she was struggling with whatever issue it was and figured that they probably all thought alike. And it was just beautiful.
Yeah, right.
It was just beautiful. And the listener had said in the summary that I hope that when I'm gone and my daughter want some advice that she'll call these lines to. It's just sweet. It was just lovely.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like I said, you know, on that clinical piece, I mean, one of the reasons why that summary exists is for me, so that when I read something, I also have to take care of my listeners. So if I see this was a really difficult call, I mean, they wonder if I sleep, I'll text them and I'll be like, hey, good call. It seemed really difficult, you know, and then I'll do the debriefing to the touch base. And then every 2 months we do coffee and calls with staff on Zoom,
right.
We've got over 100 volunteers. So we kind of go over calls and what have you. And
right.
Don't forget, a lot of these guys haven't ever seen each other. They'll talk to each other. So it's really been kind of fun being able to do that.
And along those lines, are there other ways that the call listeners can do self-care, maybe after a difficult call or, you know, when they've had a series of calls during a shift?
Absolutely. We actually, we did an in-service because we also do in-services. We did an in-service on that in December. And it was really nice listening to our volunteers. Copline became a really valuable tool for them in their own personal world is that so many of them during their careers had shut their spouses out, that what we're finding is that they are allowing their spouses in for the first time. So on those difficult calls, when they get off the phone, they'll now start to share. And one of the volunteers was started to talk, and his wife, he said, my wife just grabbed my hand and said, come on, honey, let's go for a walk. And they're able to do some walking and talking. So as long as they do that, they also are on the lines with a partner. So a lot of times that they will, you know, call each other, interact and address those types of, you know, the calls that they had and kind of the good, the bad, the ugly of those as well. And then, like I said, they do have me as clinical backup.
Do you ever get a partner calling and saying, I'm really worried about my husband, my wife? They're saying things that really scare me. And how do I know if this is serious or not? Like, do you get calls like that?
Yep. They're called third party calls. So okay. We get spouses from friends, from work partners, from what have you. But the answer is yes. We actually get a decent amount of third party calls. And a lot of times it is the spouse that notices the changes.
Sure. Right. Yeah, before, and so then how does the listener help them? Like, how do they counsel the spouse, the partner, the friend?
So, you know, more than counsel, because they don't really do that, is that they will, again, same active listening skills. So you go on, and then the listener might say, when did this start? And they say, well, you know, I started noticing it about 6 months ago. And then the volunteer might say, what happened? Was there anything that happened 6 months ago? Well, you know, his mother got sick, blah, blah, blah. We could do it, you know, it could be off duty, or a lot of times officers do not realize after critical incidents.
Right.
How they're encoded. You know, I call it the 6 and 2 in my practice. 6 weeks before to 2 weeks after any critical incident, every year you start seeing that the body remembers what the mind tries to forget, is that sleep patterns start to become off, irritability, outbursts of anger, all the stuff. I mean, you know.
Substance use.
You know that. It all goes up. So being able to, and again, in these 45 hours, they're trained. I mean, this is stuff that I spend quite a bit of time with. I get the post-traumatic stress component of our training. That I really hone in on and asking questions and making sure that these things are kind of thought about or what have you. And again, they're not clinicians. They're not licensed. Right. They're not anything. Right. But to be able to help somebody. And then one of the key things that the listeners make sure is, you know, if it was you, Stacey, that called, is to say, you know, Stacey, this must be really difficult on you. How are you doing?
Right.
Because that third party call is, you know, I'm the caregiver. You know, and I've been giving and giving, and yet how many of us are just wounded caregivers ourselves, and we're exhausted, not just them. So we really keep them very mindful of checking in with that third party caller, including, you know, the work partner that says, this has got to be difficult for you to balance trying to cover, you know, cover their ass and make sure that they don't fuck up. And then it rains on you. Like, that's got to be really stressful. How are you dealing with that kind of stress?
Right.
So I, you know, again, I remember one of our first volunteers, Dave Hall, God rest his soul, just retired captain from San Diego Police Department. We never get to identify people, but I do. He's passed. And I remember him. I remember saying to him, because he was struggling, he's like, you know, I've got to kind of undo this. And I said, you know, I know it's really difficult, because what we're telling you to do is against everything that you do. And he said, no. What you're telling me I can do is, when I took this job 35 years ago, I thought I was going to be doing. And now what you're telling me is, now I can finally do it. And now I have to learn, you know, what it would have been like for me to actually have done it. And it's so true. It's really getting back to what they believe they're taking the job to do, which was to help people.
Absolutely. Right. So,
So Kaplan really, affords them that opportunity.
It gives the retired officers a sense of purpose and meaning, because that's so critical in such a, I would just say, a masculine role. And, when men retire from being an officer, they really do struggle with defining themselves. Not that female officers don't, but I think that women in general will probably just sort of step up to, the grandmotherly role that, they'll just, they don't tend to struggle with a loss of meaning or purpose once they get to a certain age. But I think that men and many police officers, firefighters, when they retire, there's this sense of being lost and being useless. So I think it's great that they could, volunteer on Copline. I think that more retired officers should be allowed to be a part of peer support, especially in the department that they just left, because they know the department. They're seasoned officers, So I don't know why we don't have more retired officers and firefighters, participating in these types of ways.
I mean, the wealth of knowledge that they take. Is just, which really can be utilized, which we're seeing now. That's why I say I'm really a small cog. I mean, these men and women, they are on these lines 24/7. I sleep. People mm-hmm, take care mm-hmm. of
right.
us. What a great thing,
And the trust is there because I think a lot of people that work with first responders know that they don't talk to just anybody. And so for them to be able to pick up the phone in a time of crisis, or even just to get something off their chest, they want a fellow officer, even if they don't know them, or maybe they don't want the person to know Correct. Them, but just to know Correct. The work that they do, so they don't have to explain it to them.
Right. They speak the same language. Absolutely. They come from the same culture.
Yeah. And what a relief that is, to be able to just instantly, within, seconds of dialing the number, to have a conversation with somebody and just start unloading.
When you start dealing with a nation and, things like we have DIFAS here in New Jersey, which is Division of Youth and Family Services. So I'm looking at your face. Where
Yeah. So
other states, it's called something else. Correct.
States,
so, a 5150 is a mental lockup in California.
Yeah.
And a country song, but, and back east, that's not the code for it. So one of the challenges with my guys has been in training. I said, you have got to ask questions. Well, of course, their fear is if I say to you, I'm not sure what a TAT maneuver is, that they're going to think, the caller's going to think, well, because you're full of shit and you're not really a cop.
Oh.
And I said, here's the thing. I much rather somebody say to me, I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying, because right. where I come from,
we might call it something different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm like, I love the fact that somebody actually gives a shit enough to take their time to make sure that we're on the same page.
Right.
So, again, it's in training. It's mm-hmm. that's in training.
The other reason why I think this is so important for police is because with fire, you after a call, you can go back to the station and kind of sit around and have a meal and talk about it. And maybe you're sort of unintentionally debriefing right there. But a lot of times cops will just get back in their cruiser after a critical incident and they're alone. They're mm-hmm. alone with what just happened, what they saw, what they heard. And then they don't really have a chance to talk about it. Okay. So that's dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's wonderful, you know, very, very astute observation is they become alone in their thoughts and their feelings. Whereas when you're at the firehouse, you know, those thoughts and feelings, they're not alone. You know,
they're not alone. Or somebody else says it, what you were thinking or feeling, and it kind of gives you permission to have been afraid or have been angry, whatever the case may be, or have been sad because a child died.
Even outside of the firehouse, it's rare that someone's responding to a call by themselves or operating by themselves. It's just a different concept. Stephanie, I wanted to ask, speaking of departments, two-part question. You talked about LAPD, how supportive they are. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if all police departments are supportive of Copline or what you're seeing with that. And then if you don't mind touching on how the stressors of working in a small town department are different than working in a big city department.
So anybody who I've spoken to regarding Copline, I think they're very receptive to it. I think by vocation, they're suspicious anyway. It's nice kind of being around for this many years. We have a really nice reputation. So we have enjoyed that. It still is difficult because I find, and this will frustrate me, I'm sure, until the day I die, I still find that, you know, that people talk the talk of, you know, of first responder wellness and the importance of all of these things, and they do not back it up. So that becomes incredibly frustrating for me, and I always try and keep my mouth shut, which is really a task in and of itself. So we try not to put me on too many podcasts, by the way. So that's what I find. But I have not met any resilience or resistance with Copline. It's trying to get the posters up in, you know, in the departments. It's trying to get the, you know, wallet cards out. A lot of these wellness apps that are coming out are great, and Copline is just built into the wellness app, so they can literally push a button and off they go. So that's this generation.
I know this is this would take a huge effort, but is there any attempt to try to get Copline into the hands of whoever the peer support team leaders are for departments?
So truth be told, Illinois State Police has turned over their peer support hotline to us.
Oh.
And then the state of Texas actually is starting something, in that we are on everything that they have is supporter of Copline. So the answer is yes, and that is a great way of doing it, because we really are clean. Like, we don't step on anybody's feet. We're not peer support. You're never going to see us. It's wonderful to be able to to then have a peer support as our resource, is to be able to say, hey, you know, does your department have peer support, so that you can reach out to them as well. So we really just become a supplemental. You know, I like to say that we can take you, you know, from a 10 to a 7, get you through a night.
Right.
You know, and we can be there for however long you need, for, you know, months, years, or what have you. But until you can go get, you know, a either higher level of care or a different level that better meets your needs. And you had mentioned stressors between large departments and small departments. My heart goes out to the small departments, quite honestly. And part of that reason, and I'll address Jersey, it's the one I'm most familiar with, is a lot of times there's been residency requirements, so that when you have short towns, which can go from, you know, tens of thousands over the summer to a couple thousand in the winter, and you've grown up there, every call is a critical incident, because it's not just, you know, 187, you know, Spring Street. It's 187 Spring Street. That's my aunt's best friend's May, who I used to go over to her house and have dinner with. What the hell's wrong with May? So the familiarity in these small departments, and I'm not going to get into the politics, because politics are in small departments and large departments, and anybody that's listening, they all suck. your fantasy that the grass is greener anyplace else, it's not. And if you want to stop bitching, then promote. You know, if you want to solve the problem, you've got to become, you've got to go into the system in order to do it. Mm. Otherwise, your bitching is just, you know, mental masturbation in my world. So, but anyway, so I find that whereas with big departments, most of the time they're not patrolling the areas that they grew up in. So though they have, you know, horrible calls and the bureaucracy is different, the structure of promotions can be different and sectors or what have you. Mm-hmm. But as far as I'm concerned on an emotional level, the smaller departments, and now, you know, we're back here, we're back east, but now you get into your Oklahomans and your Texas, which are your at will states. In Oklahoma, you can have a gun badge and patch. You could be working at 7-Eleven on Tuesday, have a gun badge and patch on Wednesday, and it can take a year for you to be trained at a police academy. And you can be a single unit patrolling an area the size of Delaware. Hmm. And it's at will. And you're working, by the way, for $12 an hour.
Huh. Interesting stuff. And what a perspective you have from your... from doing this. It's very impressive and fascinating. And as we wrap up, is there anything that you'd like to mention that we didn't cover?
No, I'm really just grateful for both of you for doing this. I know what it takes to do a podcast, and you guys are so organized and stuff between scheduling and what have you. It's really, really lovely. And your dedication to making sure that as much information can get out there to first responders. I really am very, very grateful to both of you for doing this.
Thank you, Stephanie. And we're grateful to you for sharing your mission on our show. And I'm sure it's going to be valuable to our community. Just to make sure that everybody knows, how can people get in touch with you?
Me personally, a director at copline.org. So you can go right onto the website and you can hit that up, or the email is director@copline.org.
Okay. And you guys are on social media.
Oh yeah. I forget, you know, I'm older. So what is it? What is, like us on Facebook, something on Twitter, something else on LinkedIn, but yes, the answer is yes. Right.
I think we have your handle right here. So
yeah,
it's all good.
So I appreciate all of that, but absolutely. And that does seem to make a difference, and being able to help us get the information out.
Oh, absolutely.
That is the biggest piece. Is anybody that watches this, if you can just blast this to people so they know they're never alone.
Well, fantastic. Again, thank you. And on behalf of Dr. Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Rumeley, LCSW EMT, we want to invite you to like and subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's Responder Resilience. On Facebook, it's Responder Wellness, Inc. We're on BBS Radio, Apple Podcasts, and our website is ResponderTV.com. So until next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself. Take care.